Next speaker, this is a change in the agenda. In your agenda, it says Randy Wallace. But so Rebecca Coyle, the program manager from Idaho, will be our speaker today. She oversees the state immunization program, which coordinates the Idaho Vaccines for Children program, operates the registry, develops education and outreach activities, and organizes the perinatal Hep B prevention program. Prior to becoming the program manager of Idaho, she was a public health advisor with the CDC in Minnesota.
Well, and I apologize because I really wish Randy could be here because she's incredibly prepared and very detail-oriented. And unfortunately, we've got a lot of budget issues back in Idaho, so she's unable to join us. And I was listening to that bio and I'm like, did I do that? She's so prepared, she even sent in my bio, so I appreciate that as well. So I wanted to kind of tell you a little bit about what we're doing in Idaho with adolescents. And I guess one of the reasons why we're trying to be a leader in this particular area is that when the first NIS teen publication came out, we were really anxious. Idaho in general is in the bottom for immunization rates. And so we're, you know, really worried in this category. And certainly for our very young children, this year we are dead last. So we wanted to try and get on top of this at the very beginning before this becomes more of a requirement for each state. So that's why we have kind of taken this to the next level. So we decided to start looking at our adolescent providers in 2008, and this is for the calendar year. One of the things that we wanted to do is make sure that we could increase immunization knowledge about adolescent vaccines, and then also raise our immunization rates. So our visits that we actually conducted consisted of several components. The first one was that we would review the standards for pediatric and adolescent immunization practices, just like we do with our very young children assessments. And then we would also conduct an assessment. The selection criteria for our 2008 site visits, it worked out to be about 5% of our total VFC population, which in Idaho is about 320 providers right now. So we're not a huge state. Of the 5%, the areas that we really wanted to focus on were providers that specialized in adolescents or saw adolescent children. Within the clinics and our assessments, we reviewed up to 30 patient charts. For some of the smaller areas or specialty clinics, we did just whatever they had available for us. We also defined our active patient as someone who had been in the office for a visit within the past 2 years, and that can be for any reason. And then our state staff, really it was Randy, who went through and entered all of that information into COCASA. And then the antigens that we selected to look for coverage levels include 2 MMR, 3 hepatitis B, 2 varicella, 1 TD or Tdap, 1 meningococcal, and 3 HPV. Now, just to also kind of give you an idea, Idaho has no adolescent requirements at all for school. And in fact, this age group that we're looking at didn't even have school entry requirements. So really the population that we're assessing, the last time that they were required to get vaccines was 18 months of age. So that's kind of what we're up against. Once we looked at those different antigens, we would use the summary report to evaluate their coverage levels, and then we would also look at the missed opportunities. And I think that is one of the biggest tools you can utilize within COCASA, is that missed opportunities report. And then we'd also have a list of the missing immunizations. We would also conduct a feedback with the providers, and as with any type of AFIX assessment or feedback, you want to make sure that you include your key office personnel. It doesn't necessarily do you a lot of good if you are talking to the medical assistant who has no power whatsoever to make any kind of change. So that's certainly key for this area. So the office managers, the key physicians, head nurses, they were all very instrumental in making changes in this process. One of the areas that we really want to focus on are what are some of the things that they are doing well and how can they improve upon that. We also want to talk with them about those missed opportunities. And I think, like I was saying in the last slide, that missed opportunities report is often so black and white for providers. It really shows them that, no, you thought you were doing everything, but this is, you know, really showing you that you can do a little bit more. And then we'd also follow it up with best practice recommendations. What are some of the things that they can do within their practice to increase adolescent immunization rates? So some of the best practice recommendations that came out of these site visits were to develop a system to encourage the 11 to 12 year old population to come in for a visit. As I think most people are probably aware that teens don't really seek out preventive health services. It is only to manage the damage, and that's it. So when they show for 11 and 12, it's usually a broken arm or something. But we really want them to try and get them in for that well child check. And then to review those immunization records at sport physicals and at sick visits. And I realize that sport physicals, depending on where you are, can kind of be a source of angst for some. However, that's often the only contact with that adolescent. So in our minds, it's take advantage of every opportunity that you have. Another recommendation was to implement a reminder recall system. Look at your population, figure out who you want to target, and get those kids out there. A lot of parents, I think, are just unaware of what their children need at that age range. So if they are reminded and told that they need to bring their child in, they will most often do that. Following only true contraindications, and most of these best practices are the same for your very young children as it is for your adolescents. One of the big things that we struggle with is offering all ACIP recommended vaccines. Some of our specialty providers, we call them specialty providers, which would typically be juvenile corrections or university, they wanted to pick and choose which vaccines they offered. So really recommending that they implement the entire schedule. And then finally, utilizing our registry to help with managing a child's record. So the results of our 2008 site visits, we looked at the immunization rates, and I really think this is quite interesting in some of these areas. As I mentioned before, there were no requirements for these children beyond 18 months of age, which could potentially explain the difference between what the NIS, and again, this is national NIS, not Idaho specific, why we might be a little bit lower in that category. But I was really surprised to see how high our one TD or TDAP rate was. I think that's, I can't explain that. I have no idea why. And again, this is just a sample of our providers. This is not representative of the entire state. So some of the successes that we had, as you just saw from the previous slide, is that we had a high TD or TDAP and a high meningococcal rate. And then, some of the other things that we had are that the adolescent AFIX visits, they promoted provider change. And I think this is a true demonstration of how successful this is. Within the clinics that we visited, we had 67% of those implement at least one of the best practice recommendations. And we looked at these providers 4 months post-visit. So they had some time to implement the change, and then we followed up with them at that time. And then I think the other big thing is that 80% of these providers visited are now offering all ACIP recommended vaccines. And this is, we didn't just go on their word, we went in and we checked our VACMAN reports to make sure that they truly were ordering those vaccines. I think that's a tremendous increase, and I think this just shows the importance of conducting these types of visits. Some of the things that we discovered that are more in the obstacle category include missed opportunities. 93% had a high percentage of missed opportunities. So there's several reasons why that might be. First of all, as I just mentioned, they weren't offering all ACIP recommended vaccines. So you have to have the vaccine in the office to make sure these kids get vaccinated. And the other thing that we saw is that these providers were not documenting a varicella history. So children that had actually had the disease, it wasn't documented anywhere. These could be some of the reasons. I'm sure there's other reasons as well. The other thing that we saw is that screening the immunization records were not occurring at every visit. Over 40% of our providers were not doing that. Our picky specialty providers, I mentioned this already, that they wanted to pick and choose which vaccines they offered. And then finally, very few providers actually had reminder recall systems in place for their adolescent population. And I think this, again, kind of focusing nationally on the whole adolescent population, I think this just goes to demonstrate how isolated this group has been. There has been no focus at all on this age group. So I think it's really encouraging to really focus on these and to be able to see such instant results. I think our assessments are very key to working with providers to show them the missed opportunities and how they can increase the immunization coverage levels for that age group. And with that, I'm done.
Thank you.
Well, thanks again to both of you. What questions do you have? And if you'd come to the center mic and feel free to ask some questions.
Hi, Nathan. I'm Marsha Levin from Chicago. I have questions for actually both of you. You know, how does data get into your immunization registries? Is it just keyed in by your providers, or are there other methods of getting data into your registries?
We have a web-based registry, and the providers are encouraged to report electronically. There are interfaces with several billing systems that enable their immunization doses to be put in that way.
Okay, that's what I was
So there are really a variety of, thank you, of different ways, but they're also able to be reported on paper, and we contract an organization that then keys them in.
Okay.
So there are probably a dozen different ways.
And Rebecca, do you know?
I can echo the same thing.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, especially because, well, Jennifer did, you know, her second assessment based on, you know, registry data. So I was wondering whether or not that was really a reliable, but if you're getting it in different ways, then that makes it more reliable.
You know, I think that I was interested to hear what Rebecca said about the antigens they assessed, and those are really appropriate antigens. We had, because of our school requirements, such high levels of those antigens already that we didn't feel it was as valuable to include those in our assessment, and
yeah.
So we targeted those specific vaccines. And I think nearing the requirement and after the requirement went into place, just looking at those vaccines, we didn't have as many issues with something that may have been given 5 years ago and not reported because they were newer vaccines.
And my second question was, and I'm not sure, maybe I missed it, but what was your inclusion criteria for these adolescent patients? Because we've had these conversations, you know, even in the past when we were first talking about adolescent assessments. And so I was wondering what you used for inclusion criteria. Was there a minimum number of visits that they had to that provider, or did you just put everybody, or?
For the registry-based, and there were two registry-based assessments done in August and October, mm-hmm. and it was just any child who was identified in the registry as that providers. And for the chart-based assessments, we asked that the providers see them as active
just that
patients.
The provider defined them as an active patient.
No, I'm sure we had a criteria for that. The TMF folks may remember that, and I wrote it. I think it was they'd been
once in the past year.
Okay.
So they visited once in the past year. Okay. Rebecca, did you have an inclusion criteria?
Once a visit within the last 2 years.
One visit in the last 2 years. Okay, because, you know, that's where that, I think, really does help to validate the fact that these patients are active and being seen versus just having shown up somewhere on their roles and not necessarily part of the population. So thank you for those answers.
My questions were related to the inclusion criteria. I'm Kristen from North Dakota, and we're just starting to pilot our adolescent APHIX too. Thing is, almost all of our adolescent shots are given through public health because they go into the schools. And so as I'm going through a large public health unit, you know, those kids haven't been seen since 94 or 95 as I'm going through their charts. So 2 years doesn't seem very long when you're looking at public health, you know, for inclusion criteria. So does the CDC have a standard that they want to use yet for inclusion criteria is my question.
That must be for me.
Yeah.
You know what? I don't have the exact, do you remember? One visit in 2 years is okay. Yeah, we have put out some standards, and I could, if you come up later, I can get those to you. We do have
okay.
a few standards.
So they use the same for the adolescent. There's not a difference from.
It's different than childhood. Is that what you mean? Yeah, the standards are different for adolescent than they are for childhood.
Okay.
If you come up later, I can get your email address and send those to you.
Sure. Other than that, with public health, I'm really struggling with it because it's been so long. And when I go to the private providers, I haven't started looking yet, but it's not going to be very accurate, you know, because most of them have been seen through public health. So I don't know if you have any suggestions on how to differentiate, you know, as I'm going through and.
When we did the chart-based assessments in August or in 2007, based on that August 1st common review date, at the time of those visits, the providers were given educational materials and encouraged to provide all of the adolescent vaccines. So your strategy with private providers might be to let them identify, and I'm not sure if we use the two-year criteria. I'm sorry, I should have reviewed that before I came, because I thought we had allowed a larger time span because adolescents don't usually get seen every year, but we would encourage that you provide that kind of educational piece when you go in. And, you know, you may have to make your own determinations that are appropriate for North Dakota.
Well, and my struggle has been, because last year I wanted to start doing it, but we had to get our registry to the point where we could do queries on HPV and things like that. Our program manager, because there's so much travel involved, because there's only like two APHIX people for the whole state, is she didn't want to do chart-based. She wanted to use a registry because we have a good registry. Coming in. With the private providers, how do we not do chart-based? Because it's not going to be a good picture of their clinic.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the questions I was going to ask Jennifer, and similar to what Marcia asked, I think one of the challenges of doing adolescent APHIX is frequently registries may not be as well populated for that age. And it sounded like Jennifer had a well-populated registry, so that was going to be, do you have a well-populated registry at that age?
We have a very well-populated registry at that age now, but in 2007, we were really uncertain about that because we figured we would face what you're concerned about, that these children may not have been seen, and
right.
and we wouldn't be able to identify which providers they belong to. So that was a big concern, right. and that's why we elected to do the chart-based.
Our registry is well-populated for that age, but you know, it goes through the last provider visited, and so most of these kids are using public health.
You know, if you wanted to try something kind of creative, you could pull from your registry children in a particular age cohort and run lists of them who are missing immunizations through COCASA. I mean, import them into COCASA, run missing IMs, and then send that to the provider to validate, is this accurate or not?
Yeah.
Are these still your patients? And you can delete the ones that aren't. Sometimes
right.
when we are doing, if a provider is really motivated to improve rates, sometimes they'll ask us to assess them electronically every couple of months. And if they're in remote location, sometimes that's the way that we'll do it.
Okay. Come up here at the end and perhaps Shannon and I could talk with you some more, get your email address at least.
Good morning. I'm Jerry from Wisconsin. I have a question for Jennifer. You indicated that several of the adolescents, or there was an increase in TD over TDAP. Did you do any follow-up with the providers to see if it was provider attitude, provider information, or why they chose TD over TDAP?
That's a great question. We haven't done any kind of follow-up with the providers involved in this since the assessments were run in 2008, and that is a definite deficit in our process, and it's simply because we're in an extreme staff shortage. But given that I'm the person who gets called most often by the school nurses, I think I know what it was. My guess is that there were a lot of providers particularly in our more rural areas, who just were not in the swing, whose staff was not in the swing of giving the TD. It really highlighted for us the need to continue those efforts at educating providers. And we did receive, while we were implementing the school requirement, calls from school nurses who had gotten records back showing that students had received TD and DTaP. So we were doing a lot of follow-up as those problems came up. But we did find there were medical assistants out there, may not have been the ones who were out there when we did our 2007 visits, who did not know the difference between DTaP, TDAP, and TD.
Thank you.
Good morning. Fernando Isern, I'm chairman of the Pediatric Council of Puerto Rico. And comments. One, maybe the problem with the TDAP and TD. Some insurers still don't cover for the TDAP. There's only covering for the TD. And it will go away with time because it takes time to incorporate it. The second thing is, fortunately, we have mandated up to college, the education system must insist on vaccinations. And Ms. Cole, if you don't have it, I suggest that you do a hard lobby for the education system to insist that they be included. If providers, especially pediatricians, don't want to see them or don't apply, they should at least inform where they can get those vaccines. Another strategy is to see where they are going. Sometimes they don't come to visits to our offices, but they do come to dermatologists. Dermatologists don't vaccinate, but you can have a campaign for them to say should go and check with your primary care physician these vaccines that are now available. So if you get the ball rolling, those numbers are going to go way up.
The dermatologist is a really good idea for adolescents.
Yeah, we were looking at allergists and a few other specialty groups as well. As for the policy decisions, it's incredibly difficult to make any kind of requirement changes in Idaho. I can't tell you how difficult it is.
One issue that you can bring up, it's a form of institutional child abuse. If you do not provide the same care for kids up to 21 that you do for younger kids, it's all pediatrics is from age 0 to age 21. And sometimes when you can get the most vocal people on board, they start listening.
I have a question for Rebecca. For those, you're new in this process of doing adolescent aphids, and for those out here who are trying to figure out how to get into a provider office and how to really get this process off the ground, was there anything that was key to let providers that allowed you into the provider offices to do this adolescent aphids?
I think we have a really good relationship with our providers, and so for the most part, they're used to us coming in already for the childhood assessment. Most of them, I don't think any of them actually question whether or not we should be doing adolescents. So for us, we had a really good in, and it worked really well for us. Use the relationships that you have if you're worried about making more things. I guess one of the things that we found with our assessments In the family practice settings that we conducted the adolescent assessment, we also did a childhood. And if you do both in one shot, it's incredibly time consuming. And so that's something you may really differentiate between when you're looking to set up these site visits. If you do a childhood on one day and then maybe an adolescent the second day or down the road, just because it's so time consuming and there's often so much information that you're trying to get out for the childhood and then to throw in your adolescent on top of it, by the time you get to that, they've often quit listening to you. So I guess that would be my only word of advice is just look at how you structure it and if you can, maybe separate it.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Ruth Gubernick from New Jersey, and we did a pilot last fall in some primary care private practices for adolescent review. It was chart review. We did 30 charts, and we actually chose just 13-year-olds to look at to see, you know, so we could really see those who should have gotten shots by 11 to 12. We also did the whole string of vaccines like you did in Iowa. And that was good, even though there in New Jersey, we have a lot of school regs that, you know, that covered all those, but it was really an opportunity to show the staff, pediatricians and staff that, wow, look at the great job you've done with the shots, you know, so here's an opportunity to, you know, to get those MCV and Tdap vaccines in. It was interesting, there was one practice that, you know, they do a great job with immunizations and their MCV rates were like in the toilet. And it turned out that by policy in their office, they weren't giving it until 15 years of age. And as a result of us coming in, they, as a group that day, they said, you know what, we're changing, and they changed the policy. So that was pretty powerful. The other thing we did was, as part of our feedback, we were doing an educational session with them, and our physician trainer was an adolescent pediatrician, which was very interesting to me to hear general pediatricians say, you know, I'm really not comfortable with these adolescents, and to hear peer-to-peer the physicians who knew each other, but, you know, really have that ongoing discussion about just adolescent well care, not just adolescent immunizations. So one last comment. We asked them to look at the kids who had been in their office in the last year for any kind of visit, and they didn't seem to have a problem coming up with, you know, enough records. So thanks. Great job for both of your projects.